straight into it today. I am going to be competing a little bit for volume with the birds because sometimes coming, it's just gone 6 a.m. here in Australia, specifically in the Gold Coast. For those of you not from this area as well, like one of the really super weird things about this part of the country is you've got three states on top of each other. You've got Queensland, incidentally, twice the size of Texas, just for the Americans listening, thinking everything there's so big. And that's our second biggest state. Queensland, New South Wales, Victoria. Victoria and New South Wales get daylight saving like a lot of the rest of the world does. Queensland doesn't. So even though you've got these three states right on top of each other, and the Gold Coast, where I live, is sort of right on the border with the other one, you end up with this situation where people like on this side of the border, you're an hour later than on this side of the border. Super weird. Because we don't have daylight saving in this part of the country, it means everything, for me at least, and the kids as well, because they always seem to be up at 5 a.m., shifts like an hour early. So 6 a.m., well and truly into the day already. Now, it's a little bit hard to see it as well if you're watching the video because of the sort of the contrast and the bright light behind me. But it's super smoky today. So we're into Aussie bushfire season. In fact, I just put a photo on Twitter of what it looked like out there at sunset yesterday because the sun was just like glowing this bright, bright, burning sort of red colour because of the bushfires, which are really serious here. We're in a total fire ban period at the moment. Can't light any sorts of fire for any reason. If you're watching, you see them in a jumper. It's actually about 14 degrees here at the moment. It's a little bit chilly. I saw 38 and a half. Day before yesterday. Celsius too, the modern one. So it's so just that sort of time in Australia at the moment. Anyway, I've got a heap of stuff to talk about this week, including a new blog post, which thank God I've actually found the time to do. But I thought I just should jump straight into it because one of the things that consumed a fair bit of my Twitter bandwidth this week, and I'm going to sort of go through each one of these in a little bit of detail today. One of the things that consumed a bit of my Twitter bandwidth was NordVPN and credential stuffing. Now, Nord had that incident recently where they did get a little bit owned and it made a lot of headlines. It wasn't like private encryption keys or things like that. It wasn't going to pose problems to interception of people's VPN connections. I feel a little bit sorry for Nord given the circumstances as well. It looks like it wasn't entirely their fault. Off the back of this, reporters start digging. And when reporters start digging, they find other interesting things. So Dan Gooden from Ars Technica started reporting, or rather has written a report here on credential stuffing attacks against Nord. And I had a bit of a chat to Dan about this because what he's doing is he's looking at things like Paste, where people will drop a paste on, say, pastebin.com and say, here's Nord credentials. And they're legitimate credentials that work on Nord, and this looks really, really bad for Nord in the same way as it looks really, really bad for Spotify when you see the same sort of thing. And what looked particularly bad for Nord was it wasn't just usernames and passwords, normally email addresses and passwords, but, and I'll see if, I'm trying to remember the data attribute here, but there was another data attribute which wouldn't come directly as a result of credential stuffing. So it wasn't just like username and password. It was something else about the user's account. Now, the thing with this is, and I would say this with Spotify all the time, I've written a blog post about credential stuffing in Spotify, is that once you have someone's credentials that work for a service and you can authenticate due to insufficient anti-automation controls or insufficient fraud detection controls, let's call it that, then if someone can authenticate, then they can retrieve information about the account. And what appears to have happened here is that unrelated to the other Nord incident, which was a hacking incident, now people are going to argue whether credential stuffing is hacking or not. Okay, another incident unrelated to credential stuffing. This is not related to that. And what Dan's actually done is he's managed to pull back a bit of a list here of different pastes that have appeared against, or rather what he's obviously done here is he's done a search for an email address which has appeared in multiple different pastes over time, and he's got a screen cap from Have I Been Pwned here, and the screen cap goes all the way back to sort of August. It's a couple from August, September, October, stuff predating the Nord incident. And this story has gotten a little bit of traction because people are going, wow, like Nord's got this other credential stuffing problem. And this is where it gets kind of interesting. So I tweeted a link to his story And that the title of his story, in fact, I did chat to Dan about this and said, look, you know, just be careful with the title, that it doesn't misrepresent what's actually happened here, because this isn't someone, say, SQL injecting Nord. That's not what's happening. What's happening is someone is going through going, let's try these credentials and see if they work on Nord. Oh, yes, they work. And we just keep adding them to a list. Incidentally, the dings that you're hearing in the background is someone sending me yet another data breach. Stay tuned for that one. Now, the title of Dan's story here is NordVPN Users Passwords Exposed in Mass Credential Stuffing Attacks, which is perfectly accurate. These are NordVPN passwords. They are the passwords that people have used in NordVPN. The way that has been verified is people have taken the email addresses and passwords, hit some endpoint on Nord, checked if they work. You can probably see where this is going in terms of the Twitter debate. But what it effectively boiled down to is a bunch of people arguing that Nord has no responsibility here. This is not Nord's fault. This is people reusing credentials. Now, I myself have made this argument many times as well. This isn't necessarily a vulnerability, strictly speaking, with Nord. People just have shit password practices. Now, when I say that, a whole bunch of people jump up and they start saying victim blaming very quickly, because they're saying, you're blaming the person who reused the credentials. They are the victim of this because someone's broken into their account. You're victim blaming. Now, victim blaming is an absolutely terrible word to use in this context, and I've written about why that is terrible in the past as well. There is some responsibility here with the end user. They've done the wrong thing by reusing their credentials. Stop reusing your credentials if you're one of those people. The thing is, and this is where I got another interesting reference here, is that Nord and any other organization in their position as well also has a responsibility to combat credential stuffing. They have a legal responsibility, at least in the US. In fact, there's a story here, and I'm going to link to this in my notes. Story here with the headline of FTC creates de facto legal requirements for credential stuffing and account takeover. Now, the byline says the FTC is sending a message that businesses will no longer be able to play the victim card, different victim, to the individual user. Instead, they are responsible for protecting their customers from credential stuffing. We're having legal precedents set around this. And as much as you want to argue it's not Nord's responsibility, it's Nord's responsibility. Now, there's valid questions to be asked about how far that responsibility extends. I mean, for example, is it still credential stuffing if someone has a list of 20 email address and password combination pairs and then they sit down at a PC as a human and they connect through a VPN service somewhere, so their IP address appears somewhere else in the world, and they authenticate? No anti-automation in the world is going to stop that. It might be very, very hard to actually combat that by other legitimate means that then don't have some massive impact on usability as well. Like, I get this, it's not an easy problem. But, as I said many times before, this is a shared responsibility. So individuals and organizations alike have a role to play in this. You can't just play the victim card either as the individual or as the corporate. Everyone has responsibility. So, glad I got that off my chest. Next one, DNA. Now, this is interesting. Headline here, breach at DNA test firm Veritas exposed customer information. So Veritas is this DNA testing firm. Looks like they've left a whole bunch of data exposed. Someone has found the data, contacted a reporter here at Bloomberg. And yes, I know Bloomberg has had some reporting issues lately, but let's just say from what I have seen of this, I think the reporting is fairly accurate. Now, to be clear, DNA data itself does not appear to have been exposed. It's other related information. What was exactly in here? Customer-facing portal has recently been accessed by an unauthorized user. Company said the portal didn't contain genetic data, DNA test results, or health records. The security and privacy of customer information is a top priority. We take security seriously. We have security processes and procedures in place as part of this commitment, including segregating and securing genomic data on separate systems. So anyway, they have obviously had an incident, and it's not a good look, even though it doesn't relate to DNA data itself. Now, I shared this story, and the reason why I'm mentioning it here, because it's otherwise pretty benign, it's just another generic data breach story, is that a lot of people chimed in about how you can't change your DNA once it's breached. Now, in fairness, I did do a little bit of a snarky tweet going, your DNA has been compromised, please change your DNA. I mean, obviously tongue-in-cheek. Some people took it very, very seriously, though, and said, look, I will never use genetic testing companies because of this. Once your DNA is stolen, you can never get it back. You can't change it, etc. Now, obviously, you can't change your DNA if it is stolen, any more so than you can change your fingerprints or your irises or your face if you're using that for biometric authentication. The question I would pose, though, for people that are so up in arms about this is, what happens if a copy of your DNA is obtained by an unauthorized party? Let's imagine it was the entire Veritas DNA database gets compromised. What then? Now, I got an easy answer. I don't know. And I would suspect that you don't know either. Because for everyone saying you can't change it, they're implying that something bad can happen to you as a result. Now, I suspect that the most likely thing in terms of if someone has your DNA is that it might give insight into relatives or relationships. It might give insight into predisposition to diseases and things like that. That is very personal data. But a lot of the responses I got were around the biometric authentication component of it. You can't... Okay, I am not a chemist or a geneticist or anything like this. As far as I know, you can't take someone's DNA and like reproduce their fingerprint or their iris or their face. This is not going to be something that gives you access to any sort of authentication material, at least today. Who knows in the future? And actually, this is one of the valid points. I do take on board the fact that we don't know how DNA will be used in the future. If it's compromised now and then 30 years from now, it is actually a part of an authentication scheme, or there is such a large amount of DNA data that's exposed and people start to join the dots about relationships and history and things like that. I mean, oh man, that could actually be pretty bad, I admit. But I stand by the position that from an authentication perspective, I can't see any feasible way that's a bad thing. And I get that it feels uneasy, just in the same way as when the Australian Red Cross Blood Service had their data breach, blood type was included. And I understand people feeling queasy about their blood type being exposed. But I still don't know what someone can do with it that will actually disadvantage you in any tangible fashion. So I suspect this is all just part of the macro picture of people feel violated when personal data is exposed. And it shouldn't happen, and I totally understand why people feel that way. I think we do need to look at the feelings in one box, though, and the actual practicalities of what that means in another box, and treat that a little bit pragmatically. All right, so next thing, Azure and SSL. Azure, the app service on Azure, finally has free SSL certs, which is awesome. Now, many people, including myself, have been pushing for Let's Encrypt support. Let's Encrypt support for literally years. In fact, there was a massively popular user voice out there, which was to add Let's Encrypt support to Azure. Now, I've had many conversations with people in Microsoft over the years, part of it in public, part of it in private, about pushing this. And one of the interesting things that actually comes out when you get to the core of the issue is I don't really care about Let's Encrypt support in Azure. Let's Encrypt doesn't really care about Let's Encrypt support in Azure. What everyone actually wants is free SSL. And I know we should be saying TLS, but let's just say SSL because everyone says SSL. Let's call it the padlock. Until they take that away, then we can't say that. Let's just say HTTPS. Everyone wants free HTTPS. We want the ability for someone to go, hey, I'm standing up a website. Yes, of course I want security. Click the button, get security. We want it to be free. We want it to be automated. Two of the Let's Encrypt things. The other thing about being open, I care less about. And one of the reasons I care less about it is because from the perspective of how do we drive adoption, that's not a big priority for a lot of people. We just want to be able to turn the thing on. So this is what we now have in the Azure App Service. It's in preview. It's not available for Apex domains. So you're going to have to turn it on for your www. But not your troyhunt.com, for example. So that's a little bit of a deficit. Actually, it's a fairly major deficit. I would like to see that gap filled. And I'm sure that Microsoft is paying attention to that. I don't have any inside knowledge on that. But you would imagine that's one of the things that they will add. It is in preview. This is what happens in preview. You don't necessarily get the full fat thing straight away. For me personally, I would still go and use Cloudflare. I would wrap my Cloudflare around my things and I would turn that on because I get a lot of other things as well, plus the ability to do the Apex domain thing. I would take a Cloudflare origin certificate and I'd put that on Azure and not have to worry about managing certificates in multiple places. The Origin certificate has a very, very long expiration period. It's like a decade or something. So it's good. It is a step in the right direction. There is more step required. What I might actually turn it on for Hack Yourself First, because at the moment I've got that site extension which implements Let's Encrypt, but is, I think the most charitable way of putting it, is volatile. There's a lot of stuff that can go wrong and kill the renewal of the certificate. So step in the right direction. Good on Microsoft for that. Hopefully they can fill that other gap very, very soon. Now, on to less good SSL things. Ah, Sectigo, when will you learn? Where do I begin with this? This is actually a blog post from last month, October 10. Just came across my radar 2 days ago. And 2 days ago? No, yesterday morning even. So I'm actually doing this Sunday morning. I just got too busy with other things. I couldn't focus on it. Someone's pointed this to me. Or pointed me at this. In fact, what they did is they replied to a tweet from Sectigo and copied in Scott and I. The tweet got deleted. I can guess at reasons why. The underlying blog post still exists. The title is "The Hidden Price Tag of Free DV Certificates." Now, I can't even say the title without laughing. This is all levels of shit from top to bottom. I don't have a nicer way of putting it. There are all sorts of things in here which are just absolute batshit crazy. Where do we begin with this? There's a table down here. I'm just wondering if I jump straight to the table. There's all these... And the interesting thing here is watching the way the narrative changes in terms of the way Sectigo and other large CAs that are very, very commercially focused, and Trust is another one that spews a lot of crap... Watching the way the narrative changed. So the narrative was very, very much around driving EV, got to have EV, got to have EV, got to have EV. Now, of course, the EV indicators have gone from Chrome, gone from Firefox, they've gone from Safari last year. That horse has bolted. It's not going to change. It's not going to go back anywhere in the foreseeable future. And I think that they've realized it's pointless having the argument now about the value of EV because you get the visual indicator. It was pointless before. Now the visual indicator's gone as well. So now they seem to be arguing that you should buy your DV certificate from a commercial entity, because you get things that you don't get if you get a free certificate. Where do we begin with this? So, let me just jump straight to the table, because the table's the batshit crazy thing. All right, so there's a table here. I'm going to link to this. Read it yourself. Form your own opinion. Here's my opinion. There's two columns, free DV and commercial DV. Now, just to be clear, they don't actually say Let's Encrypt here anywhere, but obviously they're implying Let's Encrypt. Plus, there's the likes of Bypass in Norway as well. So there's a free DV column and a commercial DV column, and then there's all these attributes, and they continually try to refer to how the free one is so crap and the commercial one is so good. But they do it in ways that just doesn't make sense. So, for example, the first row here is lifespan. Free DV, 90 days. Commercial DV, 1 to 2 years. And what they're trying to say is that the 1 to 2 years is better, because they're bigger numbers, right? What they don't say is that because of the fact that revocation is fundamentally broken, longer running lifespans pose risks. Having a 1 or especially a 2 year certificate means that you've got 8 times longer that certificate can potentially be misused in the event of, say, a compromised private key. Short lifespans are good for certificates. The only time long lifespans make sense is if you don't have automation in place and you're literally paying humans to manually renew certificates. If you're paying humans to do that, you're doing something really wrong. Warranty. Free DV, none. Commercial DV, yes. Now, Scott has absolutely torn the warranty thing to shreds before, and he's written a blog post, which if I forget to link to it, just Google Scott Helm SSL warranties or SSL certificate warranties. And tigers. You Google the tigers thing. There's a Simpsons quote in there. I gave him that title. I thought it was quite clever. The warranty thing is just an absolute pile of garbage. And if you read the blog post, as soon as we started pushing, going, okay, what's in the warranty? Who gets it? Who's ever claimed it? Everyone clams up so quickly, it's just unbelievable. Trust seal. You get no trust seal with a free certificate. You do get a trust seal with a commercial certificate, which means you get to put a bitmap on your page. It's a bitmap. It doesn't do anything. And what will happen then is inevitably there'll be arguments that, yes, but if people see a trust seal, they'll trust the site more. There's a really excellent white paper called Clubbing Seals. And first of all, Clubbing Seals, awesome title, terrible thing if it's a real seal, very funny if it's a security seal on a web page. Clubbing Seals, debunking the myths of the security seal ecosystem, something along those lines. And I actually saw someone deliver this talk in Amsterdam in 2015 at the AppSec EU. So this was the OAuth conference. And it was really funny because they went through and sort of talked about the seals, how a website gets the seal, and then went through talking about the fact that a lot of these seals are actually driven by dynamic results of active tests as to whether or not there are, for example, SQL injection vulnerabilities. Now, if they're dynamically driven and you monitor the presence of a seal and then you look for the absence of a seal, what does it tell you when the seal suddenly disappears? Now, there's a vulnerability, which of course can happen. Vulnerabilities slip in, except now you've got this great big indicator which by its absence tells you that there's a problem. Then what you do is you set up a reverse proxy to that website. So you set up your own website, you reverse proxy to their website. You go to whoever provided the seal to the original website. You get them to scan your website with the reverse proxy because the whole thing's very automated. And then they tell you exactly what's wrong with the site. And I say, oh, this site has SQL injection here. Oh, thank you very much. And it's a bit... Look, if you want to create consumer confidence by some indicator... Create your own seal. Go and get some free clip art. Looks like a little badge with a... Anyway. Next row. Install and support. None. On free DV. Yes. On the other... Isn't it like they don't say what the install and support is. It's just like yes. If you have something like Let's Encrypt, install and support... Like it's just the simplest thing in the world. And if you don't know how to do it, you Google, how do I install Let's Encrypt on my website? And then you find a forum. This is an easy, easy, easy thing. And one of the funny things, Scott was going to do something with this. I think it might have been Trustico was like, we will give you support to install your certificate. All you have to do is like give our support staff root access to your web server and we will look after it for you. Like give these random external strangers, yes, I know they have a security seal, but give them control of your website and just trust them, they'll be fine. Next line, cert management tools, command line under FreeDV, web interface by commercial DV. Why is this a virtue? Is command line a negative thing and web interface is a positive thing? Because you have to go to the web interface to like manually download the PFX before you can then go and manually install. This is not, doing all of these things manually is not a virtue. Oh, now here's a really shitty one. Backed by FreeDV, donations, true in the case of Let's Encrypt, commercial, reliable revenue. So the world's largest CA by a massive, massive margin is Let's Encrypt. They have donations of about $3 million a year. If you want to see who's donating to Let's Encrypt, go to letsencrypt.com/sponsors. And it is the likes of Mozilla and Google and about 20 other ranging from very significant through to massive behemoths in the tech industry that back them to make them successful. If you're worried about them and you're using your ACME protocol to renew your certificates, you can always flick from Let's Encrypt to someone like Bypass if Let's Encrypt, God forbid, does go belly up. But saying that because they're backed by a really extensive industry or set of industry organisations that pump millions of dollars a year into them is a negative thing versus the commerciality of Sectigo just does not make any sense. It's such a dick move. And then the last line here is cost. Now, actually, speaking of dick moves, sorry, I'll say the best to last. Cost. Free EV, your time and reputation. Come on. Seriously? It's going to cost you your reputation if you use free DV? This is ridiculous. And then under the commercial column, 10 cents a day. I'll tell you what, it starts at 10 cents a day. Start doing the numbers on what it adds up to. But this is just ridiculous. Your time and reputation. I mean, your time to begin with. You go to the command line, you run the automated command, you have more time than if you go to the web interface and do all the things manually and then have to renew it manually. Like, this is such crap. So I know Scott's pinged someone at Sectigo to tell them that they've really got to sharpen up their act over this, but this, I mean, oh my God, it's, yeah. I'm honestly, read it, leave your comments on the discuss bit on my blog. This is just batshit crazy, insane, and I really wish this would stop because, look, no one's arguing that Sectigo shouldn't be there and there shouldn't be a place for commercial certificates, but just like with the EV thing, it's these absolutely ridiculous, unfounded, and in many cases just fundamentally factually incorrect arguments that I really take issue with. And you got to imagine what it's like out there for the 90% plus of technology professionals, infosec professionals that work in their job day in and day out and are happy doing their normal job, probably don't pay a lot of attention to industry trends or listen to people like Scott or myself or others who sort of make it their life's work. And their exposure to the industry is reading material from the vendors, and they read stuff like this, and they don't know any better. And they think, wow, boy, it could actually be my reputation gone if I use Let's Encrypt. Well, that's just... Anyway, I've got to move on past that, because that's just annoying. Bit of good news. Let's get back to good news. LinkedIn now has a security.txt file. Now, in case you don't remember what the security.txt is, this is the proposed spec that Ed Overflow on Twitter has put forward, which effectively gives you a text file, literally called security.txt, in the .well-known directory of your website. If someone finds a security thing that is wrong with your service, they go there and say, in LinkedIn's case, they have a contact email address, security@linkedin.com. So imagine you find a vulnerability with LinkedIn, and let's face it, LinkedIn has had their issues in the past. It's like, bam, I know straight who to go to now. There's another contact here, which is a web page on LinkedIn.com. There's their public key, which is published there as well. And they've got a policy that they link to here as well, inevitably a policy about vulnerability reporting. This is awesome. So kudos to LinkedIn for doing this. And it is great to see security.txt getting more traction. So a happy story. Now, on the blog post I wrote this week. And look, I have been a bit time poor for multiple reasons lately. Some of which everyone knows about, others which have just sapped my energy of late. So I have had a bit of trouble actually getting blog posts out. But this was just one of these ones where I sat down in another hotel the other day and went, oh boy, this is a little bit crap. And basically the way that happened is I've gone to a hotel Wi-Fi often crap. I've gone, okay, I'm going to go to Xero. So the accounting software. I'm going to go to Xero.com in a tab, bam. Whilst I wait for the crappy hotel Wi-Fi to load it, I'll go to another tab, we'll do other things. I come back to that tab, and I've got a Telstra 4GX modem prompt here. Now, I typed in Xero.com. Actually, I started typing Xero and then Chrome auto-completed, but my browser went to Xero.com. And then suddenly I'm looking at a page which is not secure, and it's got a Telstra 4GX modem thing here. And I'm like, what? Like, how did this happen? And it's almost sort of funny to talk about it now because, of course, this is the way that pretty much every web page behaved up until very recently, where we started to get a lot of traction of HSTS, HTTP Strict Transport Security. Now, I'm sort of jumping around a little bit, but we've got multiple layers here that we need to unravel. So the first layer is that if you go to a domain name in your browser without specifying the scheme, your browser will default to the insecure scheme. So if I type Xero.com into the browser will go, by default, hey, let's go to HTTP0.com. If someone can intercept that request, they can read it, they can modify it, they can redirect it somewhere else. So what you would normally do is that, say, on Xero.com, they'd go, hey, if a request comes in over the HTTP scheme, let's respond with an HTTP 301 permanent redirect and a location header which says, no, I want you to go to HTTPS0.com. And now your connection is sent over the HTTPS scheme, connection is secure, no interception, no modification, etc., etc. Now, that's great, but, of course, the problem it creates is what we just saw here, which is that the first request can be intercepted. So we have HTTP strict transport security. We can add an HSTS response header only over the secure scheme, so you've got to do it on the page which is actually load over HTTPS, which says, hey, for this many seconds from now, many people use about a year, you can only make a secure request. Therefore, the next time you type 0.com into your browser will say, I know that this site only wants to be loaded securely. I will go there securely. And then, of course, you can also preload. So you can go to hstspreload.org and you can say, I want this site to be preloaded. You add a preload directive to the response header as well. And then it eventually gets baked into the browser and shipped out with the binaries, and you can never go there insecurely even the first time. So the reason I was a bit surprised with Xero is that in my experience, every time I've done this with Xero, I've ended up on the secure site. And what I actually realized is when I went to the login page, which is at login.xero.com, different domain, they do have an HSTS header, only with a max age. They don't include subdomains, and they don't preload. And what Xero is actually doing here is they're not HSTSing the home page, but then they are HSTSing subsequent pages. And that creates this risk. So the title of this blog post was HSTS from top to bottom or GTFO. If you don't know what GTFO is, Google it. And the point I'm trying to make here is that you've got to do the HSTS thing from absolute top to bottom. Missing it on that origin website, the point at which most people enter, is precisely the point where the greatest risk is, which is why we have HSTS in the first place. And if you're putting it on a subdomain somewhere down the navigation path, why wouldn't you put it on the root domain? It just makes sense. Now, this did get a bit of traction on Twitter, did get a lot of visits. Maybe Xero has changed already. I actually haven't checked because I did push this out, about 2 days ago. So I hope, 2 days ago? 3 days ago. So I hope that things have actually changed on the Xero front. This is one of those cases where, look, this is not like an immediately exploitable vulnerability. People are going to go and SQL inject their things. But it is the sort of thing that puts a bit of pressure on and hopefully gets traction. So hopefully someone from Xero has sorted this out. If you don't have HSTS on all your things preloaded top to bottom from the root domain, include subdomains, the whole thing, ask yourself why not. Get that stuff done. Okay, so that was everything that I had this week. The last thing, sponsorship this week, is Varonis. So Varonis has been sponsoring my blog for some weeks now. We're going to see someone else shortly. They're talking about their free video course there. They've got 7 hidden Office 365 security settings you can only unlock with PowerShell. Go to Varonis, watch that free course. While you're there, watch about the 5 free courses I've done for them. All you got to do is sign up, and they're not going to spam you. They're good people. I like Varonis. I've done a lot of stuff with Varonis before, but honestly, there's a bunch of free courses from me out there, as well as the PowerShell. Who are they? PowerShell thing as well. So go and check them out too. So that's it from here. I am, getting towards 7 o'clock. I'm going to go do a mud challenge with my 10-year-old son today. So we're like literally going to go to his school, run through the mud for about 4K, which is going to be awesome. At least I'll get some good exercise out of that. Hopefully not choke on the smoke that's out there. And I'll come to you next week.